Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me is a guy with a perfect credit score. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
That actually is 100% true. I checked maybe last week or so. This is insane, but I do have to brag about this.
You every day.
My credit score is 850. I am not kidding. It's insane. I am on cloud 9, cloud 9 right now. It's incredible.
Oh,
even my wife is like, whatever, get over it. And I'm like, I can't. I'm gonna print it on a T-shirt. I have an 850.
Well, when you wake up every other week or so and go, hey, did you know I have a perfect credit score? You know, it kind of gets, I still have it. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, that's not the case for everybody. Some people need a little help and building up to that, what took you decades to get to, I think. Mm-hmm. But we're lucky enough to have somebody that can talk with us about that, especially in the Hispanic market, which we're both a part of. We're lucky to have Daniel Chu, the founder and CEO of Tricolor. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Yeah. And so you guys are focused on the Hispanic market. You guys started in auto, it looks like, and you've expanded out. How is the market these days? And how has your mission changed over the past few years?
So we've remained focused and committed on providing what we would describe as the credit invisible Hispanic consumer with access to, one, quality transportation, but two, most importantly, financing that's affordable and that provides that consumer not only an opportunity to be successful, but long-term an opportunity to hopefully mainstream and achieve their own version of what we would call the American dream.
So the journey of your company, so you went, as John mentioned, you started off as an automotive lending company, right? Focused on the Hispanic market, looks like mostly in Texas. And you've now have also Tricolor Holdings, which is a CDFI. Can you explain for our audience what the difference is between a CDFI and a traditional bank?
Sure. They really go hand in hand for us. Our model has stayed the same. We execute what we would describe as an integrated model. We operate a retail business. We have a footprint across 7 states of around 50 to 55 retail locations. And we offer, on a retail basis, used vehicles, but we also provide financing on virtually 100% of those transactions. For us, being certified by the U.S. Treasury as a CDFI was more of a validation of our ability to actually provide distinctly affordable credit to a segment of the population that we would suggest would otherwise be subject to predatory lending.
How does that affect you from an operational perspective as well?
Again, initially, I think our the objective in achieving that CDFI designation was more around a validation, because we really believe that it was important for us to differentiate within the marketplace, given that our focus wasn't simply to build an economic enterprise. Our focus was really to actually support a segment of the population that was highly underserved and hopefully contribute to enhancing the quality of their life. And so today, as a CDFI, we feel like there's responsibility with that. But we also know that investors today also want to align with businesses that are aspiring to do well by doing good. And so we believe that ultimately there will be the opportunity to attract interest from a wider base of investors and ultimately improve our lending terms, which allow us to in turn continually improve the terms that we can offer consumers.
How do the terms that a typical Tricolor customer gets differ from what they get from a traditional bank? And also, can you also address sort of the issue, what the problem it is that you're trying to solve?
Sure. So our consumers, as you mentioned, would either fall in the no FICO category or the thin file category. And what that effectively means is they have insufficient bureau data to be scored on any FICO-based model. Everyone who is issuing in the capital markets in auto finance today, other than us, and that universe would include banks like a Capital One or a Wells Fargo or a PNC, all the way through down the continuum to subprime lenders. All of those other participants in auto finance are effectively employing scoring models to segment risk, which are FICO-based. Mm-hmm. Because the segment of the population we serve is deficient in that FICO data. Their needs are unable to be satisfactorily met by most any lender. For sure a bank, but even most subprime lenders. What we've been able to do through really a direct relationship with the consumer that we've built through this retail footprint is gather an enormous amount of non-traditional data, and using artificial intelligence, we can unlock really the power of this database to be able to utilize it and leverage it in order to actually score a consumer who has no bureau data. So, and we often say we have the ability to score the unscorable.
So it seems like this is a problem that a lot of both fintechs and traditional banks are actually tackling as well. Can you give me some insight into the data sources that you use to underwrite or score folks who, again, may have either no file or a very thin file?
Sure. So our scoring model is highly dependent on what we would call application data. It's data that we've gathered from consumers through our direct interaction with them in an application process. And so there's somewhere around 110 questions on our credit application that we would say don't exist on a normal credit application, but they are questions that allow us to collect data that we believe ultimately will allow us to build correlations between certain, call it non-traditional attributes, and ultimately probability to pay for an applicant. And so it's really not depending on other alternative sources of data that are available and becoming fairly commonplace in the market, but rather our own application data. Today, we can leverage over 25 million unique insights that we've gathered. And so our data science process allows us to identify patterns across that very robust data set that correspond with a consumer who will perform on their loan. And so we would say that if the consumer we serve went anywhere else in the U.S., looking for auto financing, they would all be thrown in one category that would feel very predatory because they don't have the ability to be scored on a FICO-based model. However, if they come to us, we can use data science, artificial intelligence, to be able to, with actually a high level of precision, predict their performance on an auto loan.
And you guys have been through a couple of cycles now. You've started what, over 15 years ago, yeah. And so so you've kind of tested the model through some up and down cycles and refined it from there. Does that mean anything for what people are expecting to be an upcoming recession? How do you
adapt? So we've been successful in navigating through a couple of cycles in the economy. We would say specifically those cycles would be the financial crisis in 2009, and then really we looked at the pandemic and the subsequent lockdown as a pretty significant shock to the U.S. economy and the
kind of disrupts your forecasts and credit models a bit.
For sure. So we've we've been able to for certain test which attributes will hold up over time and which attributes actually become more illuminating with respect to predicting performance. And, you know, we've had 10 consecutive years of capital markets access where we're proud to say that we've outperformed on every one of those ABS transactions. And we continue to develop data and or develop methodologies in our data science, which allow us to achieve actually greater precision in our segmentation ability and in our risk and underwriting process over time. And so, you know, going into a potential slowdown, potential recession, we actually see our business model as performing countercyclically, because in a recession, the uncertainty around the consumer ultimately causes most of the participants in consumer lending to hit the pause button, to kind of pull back and to really retract from the market. The consequence of that is that our addressable market really expands. More consumers who maybe have a thin file and or who maybe are marginally scorable on a FICO-based model find themselves without any access to financing. And so the number of applicants and borrowers that end up migrating toward us actually expands. And we've already started to see that trend really going back to the second half of 22. And in a year, 2022, where used car sales were down by somewhere year over year in the low double digits, maybe around 12 or 14%, we saw our business actually grow by about 33%. And so we would say that is symptomatic of this countercyclical theme that we believe
it's when they need you the most.
Exactly. And we're positioned, we believe, to continue to drive affordable access to credit and in turn an opportunity for those consumers to actually be successful. What we really believe we provide is an alternative to a loan which really maintains a very low ceiling on that financially underserved borrower's ability to ever access mainstream credit. We've been successful of the borrowers that we finance who don't exist in the bureau. We've actually been successful in building a bureau score for them, even though they don't have a social security number. We've been successful in building a bureau score for those borrowers over 50% of the time. So the mission of the company to really improve the overall quality of our customer's life, to really mainstream that customer, has been achieved in our ability to get them in a position where they can actually build a credit score and ultimately access more traditional financial services.
See, Steve, it's not all about having a great FICO score. There's other things in life too.
Oh, yes, it is.
But you know, you mentioned the securitizations, and that's packaging loans up into a bond and getting those sold off. How do you convince the investment bank and then the information you have to release to investors? Especially that first time around, when you don't have a FICO score or things that the investors are used to seeing, and you're saying, well, these other things are important. How did that go the first few times around?
Sure. So, you know, we've been at this over 15 years. I can remember back in 2008 and 2009, and for sure during that time, you know, there was a lot of disruption in the capital markets. But I can remember running around to all the different banks from Citi to Wells Fargo to Royal Bank of Scotland and Royal Bank of Canada, pitching this idea that I believed that as a lender, we could achieve capital markets access with loans originated to borrowers who did not exist in the credit bureau. And I maintained at that time that we had a lot of conviction that we could actually use data science in order to bridge that gap, in order to provide enough predictability in the absence of a credit bureau score. And candidly, my first round of pitches for a couple of years did not ever elicit any encouragement or favorable response.
Yeah. It sounds like it'd be kind of tough to convince, or you'd have to provide a lot of data.
It takes a lot of data.
Audit and verify, right, and all that.
And so 5 years into the business, we had originated a material number of loans, and you know, you actually have to have defaults if you're going to build a kind of a traditional regression model for underwriting purposes. And so we had originated a sufficient number of loans to experience a sufficient number of defaults, and we believed that our regression analysis enabled us to build some and develop some insights into these non-traditional attributes that we could correlate with loan performance. And as we began to gather data and track these loans, we were fortunate to find that in fact these correlations did hold up over time. And so in 2013, roughly 5 years into the business, we did our first securitization, and we just did our 11th transaction closed last month. And we're also proud to note that it was the second securitization that we've closed, which was rated as a social bond by S&P. So another kind of nice distinction and validation of our ability to really embed a real purpose in our overall business model and lending model.
Well, investors are looking for ESG opportunities as well. So this is that kind of helps. I imagine the discount on those first loans you sold was much bigger than the discount on the more recent package, hopefully.
For sure. I think if you looked at overall the execution in the capital markets that we've aggregated over the last 10 years or so, I think one pretty clear observation would be that we've gradually been able to improve that execution over time. So this is our third transaction that had a AAA rating by a rating agency, and our second with the social bond. And so really hand in hand with reaching some of those important milestones, we've been able to not only expand or attract a broader, more diverse investor base, but we've been able to improve our execution and ultimately improve our terms, which allow us to continue to really optimize our capital structure.
So going back to the ESG, the social bond point that you made earlier, are you facing, because you mostly operate in the Texas market now, are you facing any issues with offering sort of ESG rated bonds and securities given sort of the climate in Texas now?
Oh, good question.
We were asked that somewhat frequently when we were on the road doing marketing our last transaction. You know, I think investors overall are still trying to figure out their path to navigate through the, call it, ESG landscape. And certainly there are certain categories within ESG that have become more controversial. But we would, with a lot of conviction, contend that the purpose that we serve the consumer we serve, the problem we solve, is not really interpreted differently across that landscape of ESG investors, because to support our business model and the purpose that we aspire to achieve is really about supporting one of the most fundamental core values in America, which is providing an opportunity for those who are willing to work hard. And it's really more about humanity. It's not really a category or a topic that's subject to interpretation according to maybe one's political affiliation. If you really believe in the core values of America, you would, in our opinion, subscribe to the idea that anybody in America deserves access to a path that leads them to ultimately a better life for themselves and for their families.
Yeah, right. Get beyond the labels. Yeah.
Financial inclusion shouldn't be a politically charged topic, but it's become that way, I think, in some corners, which is interesting.
It is. And you know, we look at all of those obstacles in terms of, again, positioning as a purpose-driven business. We look at all those challenges really opportunities to explain how we're different, and to the extent we're able to continue to access platforms like this to slowly and gradually explain our strategy and our approach, we believe that it will become more abundantly clear that the goals of our company are really aligned with anyone that would subscribe to the American dream.
You know, you've certainly taken on a big market. The Hispanic market in the U.S. is, of course, huge. So what is the next step or the next issues that you guys are trying to address? Just expanding geographically or different markets?
So we would look at our strategy as one that consists of three fundamental objectives. We're wanting to drive financial inclusion. We also, as an objective, want to increase our enterprise value, the value of our business. We believe those two very much go hand in hand. There are critics of ESG themes that say, oh, you're trying to actually be profitable. How can you be driving inclusion? Mm-hmm. We actually look at that very differently. We would say that if you're genuine, if you're sincere about a purpose like inclusion, you actually have to be economically viable. Otherwise, your model will never be able to scale and it will never be sustainable.
Yeah, I think there's some confusion about, you can have rules and societal goals, and then you stick the power of capitalism against those and on those, and they'll find the power of capitalism is the creative solutions and finding sustainable long-term businesses that overcome the obstacles. Not
for sure.
It's not removing obstacles. Is capitalism can find a way, despite those. And you are a perfect example of that.
Yeah, and we would absolutely believe that, and that would really lead to kind of the third pillar. We're saying we're driving financial inclusion. One, we're building enterprise value, or economic value. Two, and three, we are trying to continually improve our capital markets access. And so when we introduce that third, we believe it becomes actually fairly clear that each of those three actually support the other two. And to your point, if you can't take advantage of a successful business in order to drive inclusion, then you've really missed an opportunity. And so we know that capital markets access is an important ingredient because we want to continue to lower our cost of capital. And we can show over time how we've passed that on to the consumer. We have continued to lower our prices incrementally over the last 5 years. And this seems a little bit counterintuitive, but as we lower our prices, we have actually become more profitable. People say, well, that's some manipulation of words. How do you lower your prices? How do you lower your prices and be more profitable?
Yeah, economies of scale. There's lots of ways.
Right. And for us, it's as we lower our prices, again, we're the only lender at scale who is able to grade or score a no FICO credit invisible Hispanic consumer. So if that consumer goes anywhere else, they can't be scored. They're thrown in one bucket. And in that bucket's not going to be going to reflect attractive terms. But because we can score that credit invisible bar, because we can tell you, and we grade kind of in six grades, A plus, A, B, C, D, and E, because we can tell you an A plus is going to perform much better than a C and going to perform much better than E. Nobody else can do that. They all look the same to everybody else. We're going to offer that A plus very low interest rates and very attractive terms. And guess what? We're going to convert all of them. And so as we lower our prices, the conversion of the borrowers who are actually going to perform goes up. And so we always say we're not solving for unit profitability. We're not trying to maximize our profit per loan or per transaction with the consumer. We're solving for total profitability. We often refer to Southwest Airlines. When Southwest Airlines went into business, it cost $50 to go from Dallas to Houston. Southwest Airlines said, we're not going to compete with that. We're going to compete with the cost of driving to Dallas to Houston. It costs $20 in gas. We're going to enter the market and we're going to offer $19 airfares from Dallas to Houston. People said, oh, you'll never make money. Well, Southwest Airlines filled up every plane and they've been the most profitable airline in history.
Well, why? The timing on that analogy profit is not great, but yeah, we get the overall point. I mean, overall, yes. Yeah.
True. Yeah, that
makes sense.
The pricing strategy still prevails, but yeah, true.
It's true. So how did you, Daniel, get into the space of serving the Hispanic community in Texas specifically?
So I grew up in Dallas. Mm-hmm. You know, growing up in Dallas, it's probably impossible to grow up here and not recognize the importance of that segment of the population to everything that goes along and sure everything that is related to growth. And it's impossible not to recognize the hard work. And my parents were immigrants from China. They came here, I think, with the goal of the American dream of building a better life for their family. And so it was easy for me to relate to that when I was observing the Hispanic community. But the Hispanic market and the Hispanic population doesn't necessarily follow other immigrant groups in terms of acculturating and ultimately seeking citizenship. And so, for example, our average borrower has lived in the U.S. for over 15 years. Well, they're not even a documented resident of the U.S., but they've lived in the U.S. for over 15 years. They haven't been on this path to citizenship. Probably a lot of it is lack of education, but they're just busy working and trying to support a family and figuring out how to fit in the overall ecosystem. And so it was clear that this consumer had a significant problem, that this consumer with no social security number and in turn no credit bureau score was really being left behind. And the reality is today, if you look at Hispanics, because they're hardworking and persevering, their income level, given kind of the same educational attainment, their income level is not that far behind the non-Hispanic population. It's maybe 10% less or 15% less. But mm-hmm. the household wealth of Hispanics in the U.S. is 85% less than non-Hispanics. Why is that? It's because they have not been able to participate in home ownership. They haven't been able to participate in home ownership because many of them can't access credit. So, you know, part of our mission to empower that American dream is with this vision that one day this consumer will mainstream, build a score, maintain that score, and be able to at some point access mortgage financing. And, you know, home ownership is the only path for that low income population to accumulate wealth. This population, the Hispanic one's been left out of that and, you know, hasn't been able to participate in what we've seen over the last 10, 20 years in terms of real estate appreciation and residential real estate appreciation. And so, you know, we believe that ultimately our model can impact that. We actually believe one day our model will be used to decision a mortgage loan. But it's all part of kind of a bigger picture and a vision to solving a bigger problem. Today, we solve a mobility problem. This consumer has to have a vehicle to survive. They can't work from home. They're in construction. They're in hospitality. They're in agriculture. They're in landscaping. They can't work from home. They have to have transportation. Today, we're solving that problem. The problem that we would like to be able to play a major role in solving is actually the disparity in household wealth. And we believe we have the technology to do it. It's when you ask about what are we trying to work on, what are we trying to do next, we have our sights on a bigger picture and a better outcome for this consumer well beyond the time they're our customer buying a car from us and receiving financing from us. So it gives us a very clear view of what we would like to achieve. And hopefully we've got a team that's committed enough and smart enough to figure out the path to ultimately deliver that level of value proposition to our customer. 80% of the workforce growth in the U.S. over the last 10 years is attributed to the Hispanic population. By 2060, one out of three people in the workforce will be Hispanic. If we can't create an opportunity for them to actually have some stability in their life, and then on top of that, actually maybe accumulate some wealth potentially. If we don't do that, we're only impairing our own probability of success. Because this is all you got to do is look at the 2020 census. Whites are a shrinking population in the US. Hispanics are driving all of the population growth. And you extrapolate that out 10, 20, 30 years, and if this population is not adequately served, it will be to the detriment of the entire country. So, you know, it's there's big implications here, but we believe that we've been doing it kind of a year at a time for 15 years. We believe that we can hopefully be a part of that solution.
Yeah, definitely. That makes a lot of sense. A workforce with a better financial situation, better educated, to help build up every way we can. It sounds like it makes a lot of sense. So no loans for NFTs or block or Bitcoin or anything like that to build wealth. That's not as reliable.
I wouldn't know how to pitch that in the capital markets right now.
Yeah, you may have trouble. Yeah. Yeah. You're the real deal on taking on this problem, a big problem and a great reminder that, you know, capitalism is about solving tough problems, not making it easier to get
for
money.
Sure.
So it's about, using the power to solve these tough things. And you've certainly taken on a big one. So lots of opportunity ahead, and we wish you all the luck with that.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that. We appreciate the opportunity to share our thoughts with you, and we love the opportunity to talk about how fintech can positively impact lives of many people who kind of get left behind, and I think in today's environment have a unique set of challenges just to make everything work. So hopefully technology can play a role in solving some of those problems, and we're certainly committed with respect to the consumer we serve.
Yeah, absolutely. Best of luck with that. That's Daniel Chu, the founder and CEO of Tricolor. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news, and thank you for listening.